Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Pavi and I will be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome and thank you for joining us. The purpose of these calls is to tell stories, stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us through their actions to live in a more service-oriented way. And behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. Today, our special guest speaker is Deborah Roberts, a beekeeper, writer, educator, and much more, who embodies today's theme of the sacred path of bees. Thanks again for joining today's call. We'll start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves. Thank you, and welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call, today in conversation with Deborah Roberts. Here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Luann Cooley, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker, Deborah. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A and circle of sharing, where we invite all your reflections and questions. I've opened up the queue right now, so at any point you can hit star 6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. Now, with no further ado, I'd like to introduce our moderator, Luann, for this morning. Luann is a mother, a grandmother, a farmer, gardener, a lover of nature, and a writer based in Virginia, who is also a volunteer with us on Daily Good. She will be anchoring our call with Deborah this morning. Luann, please take it away.
Thank you, Pavi. As Pavi said, today our guest is Deborah Roberts. Deborah travels around the world teaching and speaking on a variety of topics, but particularly about natural, compassionate beekeeping. Beekeeping as a sacred practice and stories from her life on the Good Bee Road. She's a master beekeeper. She's founder of Holy Bee Press. She's on the board of the Center for Honeybee Research, a bee mentor for HMATSA, an indigenous learning center in New Mexico, and she was chosen as one of the heroes of Asheville in 2014. She also created the online series, The Sacred Path of Bees, for bee appreciators worldwide. She now resides in the mountains of western North Carolina with her husband Joe, her cat Abla, and millions of honeybees. Thank you, Deborah, for making time for us this morning.
Oh, goodness. It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I know recently you returned from a trip, and you're just getting back to your home and to your bees. So traveling the world, teaching and speaking about beekeeping has become a central aspect of your life. I was wondering if you would tell us how that came to be, how you became a beekeeper, particularly a natural, compassionate beekeeper.
Well, hello, first of all, from a very wet, green, plants-jumping Appalachia. I live where I live, the bees are within sight of the house, and they're very strong and vibrant this year. I'm so happy about that. Gosh, where my story started in respect to becoming a beekeeper was, like many things in life, not planned. Probably the best things in my life are not planned. And I have to roll the story back to the mid-90s when I met Joe and I, my husband, met in New Mexico and married and lived there for some years. And then we moved to North Carolina, which is his home state and now mine. And in the mid-90s, we met a Hopi elder named Thomas Benyaka. And Joe and I used to gather with a small group of people monthly. And Thomas happened to come as a guest from somebody, and he became the sort of featured speaker for that night. And he told us, I think he was in his 70s or 80s at the time, he told us he was sent by his elders, and goodness knows how old they were, who lived and didn't move from the Hopi Mesa, to go out into the world and carry a piece of the Hopi prophecy. So these what I would call junior elders went out at that time and did that. And he'd spoken at the UN and conferences and gatherings all over. And what he shared with us was to do with women, which was part of what he was, his part of the prophecy to share. And what he said was that from a traditional Hopi point of view, and what he called a fourth world perspective, that the woman was considered to be in charge of the table, which is, the place in the home where food and nurturing and family stories and connection happen, which is sort of the heart of the home. And in the fifth world, which is now, which is that shift has been within our lifetime, the Hopis consider the earth as the table. And prophecy tells them, their prophecy tells them that women are considered responsible for that table, which is essentially the whole of the earth. And then Thomas quietly addressed every single woman of us in that circle, eye to eye. He said, it's a woman's time to step forward. It's a woman's time to step forward. So it was a kind of profound and potent moment. And then my life moved on, and I didn't think about it until 2004 when I had a huge health crash because I had been burning the candle at 13 ends making documentaries. And I had to stop my life. And I thought I went on to a six-month sabbatical, but it turned into the rest of my life. And at the beginning of that sabbatical, I remembered Thomas, and I'd heard that he passed. And what arose in me was to drive across the country in a kind of solo pilgrimage and thank his family for this profound moment I'd had with him. And I took jars of honey with me. And I wasn't a beekeeper, but there was an old man who lived around the corner who had honey. So I drove across country and arrived at his door. It was very easy to find out where their family lived. And I came to the door and I said, I'm Deborah Roberts from North Carolina, and you don't know me, but I've come to pay my respects. Well, his daughter-in-law answered the door, and she welcomed me. And I said, may I give you a gift? And she said, yes. And I presented the honey. And she said, wow, I was just telling my husband, Thomas Jr., that we were out of honey and I needed to go to the store to get some more. So there was something, when I look back about beekeeping, about that moment, and in that moment where something bee-ish and full of grace quietly slipped under my radar and into the heart of my life. And by the end of that year, the bees got me wholeheartedly. I saw a flyer for bee school in Asheville. I didn't even really know what that was. And I took bee school. I fell madly in love with bees and never went back to anything else I was doing. And over the years, what's happened really is kind of a great billboard for do what you love and life will find you there. I've been working in my yard being around the bees, and someone or other would come along, like a friend of ours was dating a woman who went for a walk on our land, saw me working with the bees and just being around the bees, liked something that I was doing, or sort of the way that I was, and invited me to teach at Organic Grower School, which is a lovely thing going on in this area. Another woman from Turkey, friend of a friend, came to visit, saw something she liked about how I was simply being in the bee yard, invited me to teach in Turkey, and that kind of opened, my invitations to the world. So really, I've just been busy in my bee yard, which I call my sanctuary, loving on the bees, and that's opened up into the most wonderful, wonderful path that I feel such a privilege around. And my inclination has always been non-chemical in my own, the way that I would treat my own body and our dogs, our cats, our organic gardens. So when it came to bees, even though the best advice in bee school, which was wonderful that first year in many ways, I came away feeling like it was almost illegal to not use chemicals on the bees, and there was no way I was going to do that. So I just stayed with my inclination, as have many people there are more and more of us coming out of the natural bee closet, I would say. And there's a lot more people who stand in that place, but it's taken us some years to discover each other. And so thank goodness for social media and a beautiful online opportunity like this.
I agree. You've mentioned in your writings and your teachings that bees inspire mindful, conscious living practices. Would you describe and tell us what that looks like?
Well, what's interesting about being with bees, if we're paying attention, and when we're not, one of the ways that they get our attention is stinging, but that a honeybee doesn't sting casually. It has a barb on its sting, unlike every other stinging creature, unlike wasps and hornets and yellow jackets who have smooth stingers. When honeybees sting, their sting lodges in our skin and they die. So I'm never happy to get stung from the point of view of a life will be lost because of my lack of mindfulness. But mostly honeybees don't, you know, unless you're a beekeeper or in a rare situation where you're about to step on a bee on a flower or something. So over the years of being with bees, what I noticed is, when I was certain ways around them and in the bee sanctuary, it was a better, more balanced situation. Like if I was very present and focused on why I was there, carrying a clear intent, moving fluidly, slowing down. You know, it's so easy to be busy in life and busy in my monkey mind especially, so slowing that down, maintaining a positive attitude and a respectful attitude, entering with humility into their space and not assuming that I know what's going on any given day, really letting go of my notions and trying to really be present, holding an intent to be there for the benefit of another, which is the bees, rather than a human-centric intention, asking permission to be around them, asking permission to enter a hive, listening to them, and you know, all of these things, I'm in my yard every day, not in hives, but in the yard every day that I'm not on the road. So when you're practicing and then bringing consciousness to these qualities, because they benefit the relationship and help build relationship, and you're there day in, day out, week in, week out, month in, month out, then there's what I realized one day is that these things were a practice. And these qualities, these aspects of the practice were the same as, you know, any spiritual tradition I, you know, have ever heard of. And so in doing that over the years, these wonderful feelings start to well up as come with a practice, like, you know, appreciation and devotion, feelings of, you know, grace, reverence, appreciation, and compassion, you know, everything that's part of living in this benevolent universe, you know, which I believe is benevolent. And that changed my life. I realized that beekeeping wasn't beekeeping because I've never been comfortable with that language, but it was a sacred practice, and that bees, which have never been livestock with me, were a sacred relationship. And that my path with them was to learn and not to, you know, be in the commerce of bees in any way. So that really changed my life. And as I stepped forward into the bee world, I started to meet people who were also feeling that way. When I first started beekeeping, it was a different horizon, and that was only like 12 or 13 years ago. Now there's a whole bunch of people that are stepping out in this way, but I think it just took a lot of us time to find each other. And one other thing, I have one of my elder friends, Grandmother Redleaf, she talks about something called calling back the medicine, and that she gave language to something that I was also experiencing with the bees, that if you're doing something with the chop wood, carry water of looking after bees, being around them, being mindful and all these different qualities, that we create an invitational field where medicine or wisdom can arise in our consciousness. And I've found that time after time. And I think that can be true of anything that we're doing in such a way, you know, whether it's with bees or dogs or cats or plants, gardens, children, whatever, that we have the capacity to call back the medicine depending on how we walk with loving presence in the world. And I think that's one of the things that's coming into beekeeping that might not have been on the horizon when I started.
I love that, calling back the medicine. I've noticed, and you've spoken about the people that you have influenced you. But one thing I've noticed when I've looked into becoming a beekeeper is that it is very much a male-dominated field. And when I've gone to workshops, they've all been taught by men. In the documentaries even, most, if not all, of the interviewees are men. But this seems to be changing. So I'm getting a sense that just like what you're talking about, that it's moving into a more sacred experience for people, that there are also more women beekeepers today. Is this something that's new, or have there always been women beekeepers? Do you think this is the feminine aspect that women represent that's changing the ways of beekeeping?
I think in terms of contemporary times, there's been a huge change, that there's more women getting into beekeeping than ever. And from my point of view, it happened around 2006 when colony collapse disorder reared its head. This naming of a phenomenon where a lot of bees have died and been lost, disappeared from the hive overnight, and was the beginning of a very challenging time for bees, although it's been challenging for a while, kind of gotten more into a crisis. So I think when a lot of women stepped into bees, not because of commerce, but because of a compassionate response, a caring response. And that's, so this unprecedented number of women are with bees now, more than in the history of humans and bees. I think before, I mean, this is just kind of my take on things. It's not that women weren't involved with bees, but it's been much more male-influenced, much more men as the predominant beekeepers, women maybe being assistants or helping with the honey harvesting, things like that. Back in time, however, if you look at the book of Lane Redmond, who was a wonderful, wonderful woman writer, filmmaker, drum teacher, person in the world who unfortunately passed a few years ago. She was a friend and lived in Asheville in the last years of her life. She wrote a book called When the Women Were Drummers, and she does a huge history of the history of drums and women and the histories of women and sacred lineages and goddesses we've all heard of, and discovered in her research that a lot of the women that, or a lot of the goddesses that, you know, anybody might recognize, many of them were beekeepers and bee priestesses. And so when you look into that, which isn't so much, history isn't so much my strong forte, but if you look at the qualities that I experience and explain to you, that I experience in the bee art that are so sacred, I understand how lineages, spiritual lineages of women would have incorporated bees for sure. You know, in these times of colony collapse disorder, which, you know, come from, in my opinion, the widespread use of chemical treatments and pesticides in gardens and agriculture, and the suppression of swarms, which is a very natural reproduction phenomenon of bees, modern queen breeding practices where queens are killed and replaced frequently, artificial insemination, even, you know, what bees live in, what we've selected for. A lot of this has come from a form of practices that didn't have very much of the women weighing in my opinion. And women have stepped up. One, it's so interesting. I get emails weekly, sometimes phone calls, sometimes Facebook messages from women, like I did yesterday. I want to read one to you. It says, I live in a woman from Tennessee. I live in a rural area, and most of the seasoned beekeepers are men. So far, the ones I've talked to seem pretty reluctant to mentor a woman, not to mention someone who doesn't want to use chemicals. So this is widespread, but one of the things I feel like I do is connect people like this with other people who can help, because there's a lot of people interested in natural, non-chemical approaches to bees, but not everyone is finding that in their own bee communities. So with the emerging feminine, with women's ways in the yard, it's changing beekeeping. And I have wonderful men friends, men bee-loving friends. So I could also say that this is talking about restoring the balance between the male and the female, the masculine and the feminine within us, too. It isn't just about gender, but also a lot of women are stepping into beekeeping. So the qualities we're bringing are, for instance, I think listening to the bees a little more. There's a tradition of talking to bees that goes back across the centuries called telling the bees, and which is beekeepers talking about the family news of births and marriages and deaths and, you know, meaningful human events. And when the main beekeeper died, you know, black crepe or some marking of the beekeeper's death was made on the hive sometimes to let the bees know so that they wouldn't leave. So that, you know, there's a tradition of telling the bees, but there isn't the same tradition of listening to the bees necessarily. And I think that a lot of women are more inclined to do that. I put my ear to the hive every day and just listen for wellness and really just take in the energy of the hive. We also, there's a little bit more of asking permission from a hive before we get in. Women tend to paint their hives and create something of beauty as a kind of adding to the field of welcome and enchant and love. There might be sacred things in the yard. My bee yard is a sanctuary, which a lot of women would say theirs are too. So I have a lot of things around that are prayers for people and well-wishing for the bees. Lots of intentional, healthful things. We name our hives, which creates a kind of intimacy and relationship, and it puts relationship there rather than bees as business. I've laid down in my yard, and that year that I was really, really sick when I came into bees, when I had bees the first year, that really changed my life to be able to just be in the bee energy and the smells, and I'm sure that's very much why I got well. So, you know, there's this presence that, you know, a different gift that the feminine always brings, and I'm just seeing almost daily people coming to me and other women that I know who are beekeepers are kind of out there a little bit more, hearing from women with relief, gratitude, even tears, that they're not, that they're basically our inclination to love bees more than anything else isn't some marginalized, you know, hippie, freaky thing to do. It's actually the main deal.
I like that. It seems like whatever you take care of, you begin to actually fall in love with it. And the more you take care of it, the more love you feel for it. But yeah. Now, those are, I love telling the bees, but the women are bringing listening to it. That's wonderful, especially in the sanctuary. So you've talked about balancing the male and female and that can be a challenge in drawing out the feminine in all of this. But there's a tendency that many of us, especially today, have where we want to go about acting. We're going to do, and we don't actually reflect so much, and we don't really allow ourselves time to process what's going on. And I think that you're bringing out the listening as a good example of how the bees have changed you. But there's a tendency also, we don't allow ourselves time to grieve, and there's so much going on politically and environmentally and personally. You have talked about the bees and in terms of medicine and healing, and also in grieving the loss of your bees. So I'd like, if you would, to describe this and then how we can apply that to our own lives. There's just so much now, so much loss that we're feeling, and I don't think we're actually processing that.
I'm so grateful that we can spend some time on this, because grieving the loss of our bees, which is more of a feminine inclination, doesn't have a place in the bee schools. And the bee schools are wonderful. There's a lot in North Carolina. There's a lot in this country and other places. And in the bee schools, people are wonderful volunteers. They're very hard-pressed to fit a lot of information into what can be a weekend or an 8-week course or something like that. So I have an understanding of that, but to not mention it is a big oversight, in my opinion. Nowhere in Bee School did I understand how I was going to feel the first time I lost a hive. And no one, whether they're natural, in so-called natural beekeeping, compassionate beekeeping, non-chemical beekeeping, or believe in using chemicals, every one of us at some point or another loses a hive. So there's no absolute guarantees with a path, but I think a committed natural beekeeping practices by more and more people is making a difference. It's just it involves all of us. So the grieving, the loss is when I lost my first hive in the fourth winter of keeping bees, I sobbed for 4 months, and I understand what grieving is for me, but I feel like in some ways when I travel the world, I give women and men permission to feel the grief that they feel and to process it as something that's important. In the statistics of bee losses in the United States, we've gotten used to losing a 30% of our bees, which is so unbelievably high, and that's a normal statistic. 2 years ago, we lost almost 50%. I don't know what this winter's statistics are because I've been away, but I think they're in the 40%. I'm going to be in Canada end of August. I heard in Victoria and on that island, they lost between 40 and 60% of their bees. One of my most favorite beekeepers in Turkey lost half his bees. They're not all dying, but the statistics of loss increase, and it's the grieving to me is one of the ways one of the most pure and cleansing experiences that we can have. It's not a waste of time. It's not a, you know, it's again not a girly marginalized thing to do. It's holy work. And so I wrote a piece, my website called Holy Bee Press. The homepage is a blog, and in the right hand column there's a piece called Disconsos for the Bees that describes my first losses of the bees and what I did. And that's given a lot of people permission, again, in contacting me a lot over the years, in marking the loss of their bees by making a little shrine or an altar or in doing a ceremony or just simply giving themselves permission to cry, because it's, you know, when a hive dies, it's a loss in the family. You know, it might be 50 or 60,000 bees if it's an Italian, if it's a hive of Italian bees, which is mostly what we have in America. So there's, you know, there's the one bee, there's the 50,000 bees, and then each colony, there's a felt sense of a presence and a being that pretty much any beekeeper will be able to express about that. And so when a hive dies, it's a loss in the family, and Disconsos for the Bees discusses that, and it also mentions the work of the wonderful Kaylin Sullivan Tutrees, who's a friend who created a shrine for the bees that's described in that article. She does wonderful work in the world. You know, and the wonderful Sibanfu Somme, who passed in this year, she was from Burkina Faso in Africa. She was roaming the world doing a lot of grief rituals and work and workshops, and she taught about the importance of grieving, and the hanging on to old pain just makes it grow until it kind of smothers our creativity and joy and our ability to connect with others. And I think at a broad scale, whether it's the loss of bees or the challenge to health of pretty much any life form right now, whether it's dogs or cats or humans, that the grieving of the loss of these connections is something that's really important for our emotional and spiritual and then therefore physical lives. And if I could give permission or create a safe field for anybody to feel okay about grieving, I would feel like my work is very blessed in that way. It's a natural response that arises amongst women and many of the lovely men that I know too. And one last thing on this is a doctor in our area named Dr. Chad Crissell. And he wrote an article that talked about the causes of death in America, which I would have thought was cancer, because so many friends of mine have died, you know, people with great lifestyles, close friends between mid-30s to mid-60s, who have had all kinds of cancers. And he said that the highest, the number one cause of death in America is heart disease. And if we really, really look at what is that about, that a whole great body of people are dying of heart disease, what does that say about our capacity as a group of people to grieve and the importance of it, the positive expression of grief as healing? So I think this is, grief expressed is one of the ways that we can also care for the bees, because it's a way of cleansing the environment and kind of the space around them, and not just losing a hive, going out and buying new bees or giving up, but to really mourn the loss of who's died as a relationship, and then moving forward with respect with the new lives that we can be part of.
Do you experience the hives, I mean, each individual hive, because you name them, but do you experience those hives as personalities?
Absolutely. And I think any beekeeper, no matter their practice, when they are able to spend time around their hives, as opposed to the high-end commercial people who can have, you know, thousands of bees, up to 60,000 hives. I don't even see how it's possible to be in relationship with bees. But most beekeepers, the backyard beekeepers, the beekeepers, the many, many of us who are not doing bees for commercial reasons, if you spend any time with a hive, I have two that I'm thinking of right now that are in my yard, that are so different from each other. One will get up earlier than the other, one will stay out a little later, one is a little feistier than the other, one is pretty mellow. And if you use all your senses and you spend time in the yard, you build relationship, you can understand the differences and the similarities that help you get to know that entity, that superorganism, that family of beings that is one colony as opposed to another colony, that helps the relationship and that provides information about their care and how to be around them, and kind of to discern what it is that they actually need and what they don't need from us.
That's amazing. And so have you noticed whether when there is a hive that collapses for whatever reason, and do the other hives, do they seem to be aware of that? And can you tell if they are aware that the other hive is now gone?
I lost one of my strongest hives last year to a raiding incident. It was a freak robbing incident by other honeybees, not in my own yard, but from somewhere else. And what it did is, like, and number one, I think bees are aware of everything. I mean, they're very highly attuned, sensitive beings. So yes, the nature of life in the yard or the sanctuary changes, and there's a resilience with bees and a purposefulness with bees that is so inspiring that I didn't see them missing a heartbeat or stopping what they were doing. It's just sort of an accommodation to what is, a kind of being lovers of what is, if you want to look at it from that point of view. And so my time spent with the remaining hives was different. My grieving for the one hive was evident to the other bees. So I think all that's taken in relationship. And if for instance, you have two dogs in a family and one dies, another, you know, the dynamics of the family change, so the dynamics of the yard change. But my strongest perception and response to you is that the bees, in seeming to be aware of everything from my point of view, continue without missing a heartbeat in their own purposefulness, resilience as much as they have in these times, and intent to have a healthy life, to get the food that they need, to raise their young in a beautiful way, and to, you know, get ready for winter, and to keep meeting the cycles that are present in every day and every season. They're so inspiring in their resilience in that way.
I like that. That's nice. So you've talked about bee colony collapse disorder, and most of us have heard or read about it. But you also have an analogy to that of human colony collapse disorder. And this really struck me, because it seems that that's what I've been feeling and experiencing personally. And then recently, especially just witnessing this globally, but you also have presented sort of an antidote to that, and it's queen piping. I don't know if anyone or if many people have heard about queen piping. I know I didn't until I heard the recording of it. So if you would you explain a little bit about queen piping and then how we can bring that understanding and practice into our own lives?
I'd love to do that. It's interesting in these times, without getting grim, I think that, you know, so many life forms are challenged, and that's because we truly are all interconnected. It's not just a Asheville bumper sticker. We really are. You know, any indigenous tradition, any wisdom tradition, you know, points to that. And we're all sharing the same field of loving awareness and what's going on in the world. So whether it's, you know, my life, many friends dying of cancer, or I just came back from the Southwest, and a friend of mine's a holistic vet, Dr. Dee Blanco. She's wonderful. And she told me that the statistics on dogs, one in every two dogs will develop cancer by the end of their lives. That's just, these are appalling statistics. You know, we're seeing a lot of bee deaths. And at the same time, I'm strangely hopeful because of a lot of the people that I'm blessed to have come my way who are doing marvelous things, that are, a lot of them just quietly getting on with things without any, like, pomp and circumstance. So one of the... And to get onto the subject of queen piping, why it has value for this, you know, many life forms collapse or challenge times, is it just points to the way that some people are going with their practices with the bees, that are practices, that where they're bringing intent and love and mindfulness to their relationships and noticing what's going on rather than leading with agendas or the very human-centric thing that's going on of what we need from bees, looking at bees of, you know, providing honey for us, pollinating our crops. And yes, we do those things, but I don't believe they were born to serve us. We're in a field of co-creative life together that hopefully involves respect. And so with the phenomenon of queen piping, actually, I've got the recording, and if there is... anyway, I can share a link later for people who are interested, or if you just Google queen piping. I want to share about 15 seconds of it. I'm not going to play long, just so you can hear it. This is a phenomenon that I heard one night in my first year of bees when I came home from a concert of Omar Farouk Tekbalek, who'd come to Asheville, who happens to be in Asheville again this week, thank goodness. Wonderful, wonderful man. My heart was blown open. I went to the bee yard because I couldn't go to sleep, and I was saying goodnight to all my hives, putting my ear to the hive and telling them I love them as I do. And I heard this. So I'm going to play this. And it's going to take me a second here. Here we go. Were you able to hear that, Luann?
I was. Okay. Yes. You can hear the buzzing around, and then that very distinct song.
Yes, it's like a piping and a quacking. And again, if there's some way I can make this clip available to people afterwards or they can email me, I'm happy to send it. I have no idea what that was. It wasn't ever mentioned in bee school. And I asked my mentor the next day, he told me what it was, and that there's, as with many things with bees, whatever the prevalent attitudes or explanations for it that are out there, there's still more mystery than not. There's these sustained notes, and it's when the queens are not yet born, there's usually a multiplicity of queen cells with forming queens in them when a hive is about to have a queen succession for all the reasons that they do. And her thorax is pressing against this peanut-shaped cell, and it's just the most astonishing sound. I mean, some people would say it has to do with like a kind of territorialism once she's born, or some kind of battle cry for competing queens. But the thing that I found was, number one, it was holy and very, very sacred. And I call this sound the song of the unborn virgins. And it's, you know, when bees communicate with each other, two of the strongest ways of communicating are vibration, which is what this is, and also dances. So it called to mind my time with Uncle Bob Randall, who was this unbelievable Australian Aboriginal elder from, how am I going to say, is the Yankanitjar, what is it, Yankanitjatjara Nation, I try and remember how to say that, in Australia. He passed a few years ago, and he and his wife had come to stay with my husband and I, and he talked about song lines. And he said that a song line is a song of creation that sort of energizes a belonging and a connection with your place of creation, and that with everyone in that place who you're connected to, with all your family members. That's all the beings, not just humans. It's the four-legged, winged, rooted, finned people. And that also connects you to the earth, and that each child or tree or bee or animal is born to a particular song line. And so when I heard this this sound, it brought to mind what he'd shared about the song lines. And if you're a beekeeper, what you know is that in modern practices, just really in these last 8 years or so, beekeepers, everyday beekeepers in bee schools are told that it's a good idea to requeen every 2 years, maybe 1 year. And the queens can live, you know, 4 or 5 years naturally. The rest of the bees, the workers and the drones, the males and females in the hive, live around 6 weeks. So the queens have a longer life, but because of the commercial demands on bees and fulfilling pollination contracts that are such a lucrative part of beekeeping in America these days, there's this practice now of replacing queens every year or two, with the notion that a young queen is going to be more vital and more successful. And what I find very distressing is that things like, and also the practice of dispatching your queen and replacing her with one you've bought from another colony. So there isn't this song line opportunity that doesn't always happen, but when it does, it feels like some ancient way of knitting a colony, in the way that Bob talked about, where there's a mysterious connection and presence with all that is. In my yard, for instance, that would be with the tulip poplar trees and with the ridges and the sunlight and the bears and the turkey population and, you know, everything that's around. That would be part of the family of being and information and connectedness for a hive. And when that's fractured in favor of the productivity and the commerce of a hive, I feel like we're doing something that fractures relationship that's happening all over, you know, in our relationship with the natural world. And it's why queen piping for me is such a kind of beacon for let us approach bees in a different way. I wrote, Rudolf Steiner wrote some wonderful stuff about bees back in the day, and not in this century, last century. And he talked about bees and love, and he also predicted that a lot of the genetic influence everyday beekeepers could get involved with beekeepers and involved in the queens from the late 1800s, when bee boxes, Langstroth, you know, created these bee boxes that let people get in bees for the first time, unlike they could with skeps and more traditional structures, that once we got into bees, we were on... sorry, my phone just rang there. I turned it off. Once we got involved in the genetics and we started breeding for tameness of bees and honey producing and golden queens, which was a fad for a long time, all these things that are so human-centric, we did bees a disservice. And so I wrote a letter to Rudolf Steiner in my mind that said I felt like with not paying attention to the song lines and to really listening to the bees as opposed to interacting with them, with the agendas that we have, that I feel like we're losing the wisdom and the health and resilience and sacred sounds and well-being that come from bees self-determining the succession of their queens. And we're forgetting the importance of bees to select the best eggs for their future queen candidates for all the mysterious reasons that they do for their own divine purpose. And we're diminishing their input about their future. We sort of become hasty and governed by commercial needs that's put before the welfare of bees. And I would say there's a lot of poor stewarding practices, and we're doing it at the speed of light and asking, really, you know, we're asking one of the hardest working creatures on earth to work harder. And of course, they're going to disappear. I mean, they just can't keep up with what we're asking from them. And it's breaking a lot of our hearts, and that's another reason to grieve. So, you know, queen piping is interesting. There's a lot of other mysterious phenomena that are interesting, that if we could spend time with those things in from a place of humble, respectful discovery rather than assumption, then I think we would learn so much more about what the bees actually need and are asking from us, and that's applicable if bees aren't their thing. You know, just the same thing with dogs, cats, ginkgo trees, ginseng, you know, pigs, animals, anything, you know, anything alive, just whoever we love, to spend time with them, and they will tell us what they need if we're in relationship rather than in business with them.
Sure. I love it. I loved it. I had recently watched a documentary where they took the queen and did exactly what you were saying, but they were showing how they were impregnating the new queen in order to put her in the hive. And I'm not a beekeeper yet. I am a beekeeper wannabe. And was so distressed just watching that documentary. And that's what came to me after I had heard the queen piping, is that... Now, and I will ask you so that you can go into the other bees. The queen is making this sound, and that's what I took it, that it was her song, and that she was sort of calling the collective, and it allowed them to sort of the same thing as when we practice with Om or any other meditative sound. It brings us into alignment with the energy, and that's what I felt intuitively that she was doing. So when it comes to the other bees and they place the queen, the new queen that is not the one that they have learned that song, how do they react? What's their response?
Well, one of the ways, when you introduce a queen from another hive into a queen that you've dispatched or killed the queen in, which I'll never have done, never will do, but is a practice, especially with commercial entities, that she has to be introduced in a box. So you take a queen from another hive or that's been bred in a queen breeding operation, and you put her in a small box where there's a lot of breathability with a couple of her worker bees and a little bit of a candy plug, so that there's some sugar that the worker bees can feed her and live on. And you insert that box on a frame in the hive that's receiving her that doesn't have a queen. And you wait till they eat through the candy plug. That could be a day or two. Because if you put her right into that hive, the hive is very governed by pheromones and the smell of their own queen. So they're likely to kill her if they just put her right in the hive, if you put her right in the hive. So it takes a day or so for them to get used to the fact that their queen is gone. That hormone and pheromone that she emanates is also gone with her. And within a period of, you know, a day or two, they will accept the new queen. And they will allow her in, and she will lay eggs, and there will be a destiny for that colony. So that's a pretty common practice in mainstream beekeeping. And bees will accept her, but not right away, and that there's something to that. And so there's an expression called queen right in a hive. It's when a hive is, you could just tell it's business as usual. They're well with the world. They're doing what they know to do. They're healthy. There's beautiful smells and sounds coming out. And when there's, I think the song line, this is, you know, really my opinion. I really haven't heard anybody else talk about this, although it would be not be a surprise for, you know, talking with some of my compadres. I think that the song line and the queen piping is part of many, many ways that we don't even know about how a hive sings and creates its rightness and health into being generation after generation, you know, towards the seven generations unborn. And if we can be quiet enough and agenda free enough around bees and any natural world life form, that information, some of those mysteries reveal themselves to us, but it's only when we're in a kind of receptive, humble, respectful place. And also, I think the great mystery is always with us, but a lot of the mysteries are there for us to understand if we just spend a quieter, less driven sort of time.
Yes. a lot of what I have learned about the bees recently through your writings and your resources are aligned with what I believe is true with plants. You know, it just comes from a more holistic point of view. So we are getting close to the time when we'll be taking questions from callers, and I would like you to give us some advice on what we can do going forward, what we can do to help the bees. I will admit, yesterday I was on the road. One of the things that I do is stop and get a coffee and usually a bag of nuts because I try to not eat quite so much sugar. I got in the car and sat down and said, oh, I have bought a bag of almonds, and I had just promised myself I would never do that again. And I will let you explain why I should not buy almonds anymore. But if you would tell us what we can do now, and make sure that you mention what your website, what you're going to be doing next, any webinars, all of it.
Sure, I'm happy to do that, and I'll be quick because I know that we've got question time now soon and reflection time soon. I mean, in terms of my own world, it's holybeepress.com. I have a series called The Sacred Path of Bee that you can find referenced on that. And what I'm doing is I'll be in Canada end of August doing a workshop on bees and being, and I'll be in India in the fall. I'll be back in Turkey next spring. And all that stuff is usually on our website. More importantly here is, what can people do? One of my presentations is like sort of a, you know, what feels like a thousand ways and more so you can help the bees without keeping bees. A lot of people, you know, when they're asked how to help the bees, the top two pieces of advice are don't spray chemicals and plant something that's bee friendly. And that's great advice, but not everybody's a gardener. Not everybody is spraying because they're not a gardener, or they wouldn't anyway. But that I like to kind of open it up to what activism is, you know, and get people outside the box so people can relate to something that actually is a natural inclination according to their own indigenous passion. So, you know, friends of mine have done things like start Bee City USA, or they have, you know, have started organic parades, you know, in our area. There's nurseries. They're starting to provide plants that don't have the pesticides in them. There's farm to table. There's restaurants taking pride in their organic bee-friendly produce. There are all kinds of entities teaching children about how to not be afraid of bees and demystifying things. There's chefs that have bees, like the Ritz-Carlton in New York, have, you know, bees on their rooftops, and they're using the honey and they're bringing consciousness. Planting covered crops, not getting rid of dandelions and, you know, important foods. There's art. There's plenty of places I can tell you. People send me clothes and, you know, images all the time. There is definitely not enough interesting, beautiful images of bees on fabric and socks. And if you're wearing those things as I do, people inevitably start up conversations and checkout lines, and then you can, you know, pass on some good information. A friend of mine, Elaine, wrote, created Hymns from the Hive, a CD, you can compose music, you know, get a tattoo, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's amazing. But I'd say the most important thing is love is the ultimate, is the ultimate activism. And so even if your thing isn't bees, love who you love and let that love pour out, because it touches all of life. Love knows no boundaries or borders. And if there's one thing I've learned from doing hundreds of presentations to children who are some of my highest teachers over the years, you know, I've shared a bunch of really fun things and they come away with great information of bees. But the single thing that's impressed them time after time is that an adult, often dressed in antenna and wings, is that an adult should love bees as much as they love their dogs and cats and best friends and parents. And that is that love thing that touches and suffuses people, that's a total game changer. And so, you know, if you love bees, excuse me, if you love bees, I thought I'd turn my phone off here, or if you love anyone, just, you know, prepare to fall in love and let that generosity and gratefulness for whoever that is well up and out of you so overwhelmingly that you're just flowing that love out like a libation. And just, it will touch all life and it changes life even if we don't see how that works in the big picture. And where loving bees are concerned, I mean, I'd say just start finding 1,000 ways to say thank you for all the blessings that being around them will be, because thank you will never feel adequate. They're just such marvelous, marvelous beings. These, what do we call them? Angels of architecture, these precious winged rinpoches or bearers of light. You know, they change our life. They help us fall in love with ourselves and all life more than we ever thought possible. And they bring us home to ourselves, to home sweet home, I like to say.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Go on.
And I would let you, too. I have been so inspired reading your work, seeing what you're doing out in the world, and talking to you. It just has been a mind-changing and life-changing experience. So I thank you very much for spending the Saturday with me. I have new seeds that I'm going to plant and have now redesigned one aspect of my yard that I had decided was going to go one way, and now it's going to go another way. So
beautiful. Thank you. Well, thank you for the privilege of this. I really am so grateful for your questions and the lovely way you navigate. And it's I know that these are going to come into your life, you know, from former emails, and that really excites me.
Oh, good, 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 good. I'm ready for them. They're so precious. I had a wonderful spring with the bees in the meadow, and so I'm excited. I'm ready. Good. I'm ready to have more of them in my life. So.
Yay!
Thank you so much, Luann, for moderating this initial part of our conversation. And there's a lot buzzing.
Thank you, Poppy.
And as we just a reminder to our callers, as we enter the last half hour of the call, if you'd like to ask a question, you can write in to us at ask@servicebase.org, or you can unmute to ask a question, just hit *6 and you'll be added to the queue. We have several reflections, beautiful reflections that have come in from listeners and readers. Here is one of them from Kaylin Two Trees for Deborah. So much of the conversation I've heard about the bees and the decline seems to be focused on what the loss is for humans, pollinators of our food source. What can we add to that conversation that acknowledges the bees' embodiment of love and their connection to the stars? Their decline on this planet says something about the health of this planet in the whole cosmic system. They link us to the stardust from which we are made. They are the heart of our ancestral remembering. Thank you.
Oh, Kaylin, oh my gosh, thank you. So eloquent.
And I had there's several more, but as the host, I'm going to take the privilege of jumping in and asking a few questions of my own at this point. And one of the, just to rewind the tape a little bit and go back to, you know, to that time when you said you were a filmmaker burning the candle at 13 ends. And then you completely changed your, you know, the direction of your life, and it's very clear that you're doing exactly what you're meant to be doing in this world. but I was wondering if you could share a little bit about the trajectory that led up to you becoming a filmmaker and led to you visiting the Hopi Elder. Could you fill in those years for us a little bit, and maybe some of the early influences and inspirations that, and the seeds that were planted in your life?
I'd be happy to. The sort of the nutshell, I've been in arts and spirituality all my life, and, you know, I've had chapters of having a theater troupe, being in acting, being in dance and choreography, some crafts, things like that. And each has come into my life really unplanned and strong. And that's how, when Joe and I moved from New Mexico to North Carolina, I had a sort of, for me, I have chapters of remembering my dreams or not, but I had for the first month that we were here, I had a dream every single night that I was making a film, and I had no plan to make films. And in the dream, I was looking for $4 million and a crew and a cast, and I didn't know what I was doing, and it was kind of wearing me out when I'd wake up. And Joe said, in his, my beautiful husband Joe, in his infinite wisdom, he said, Deborah, if something's, you know, speaking to you from your dream time, as it has done, it'll happen in bite sizes, you know, you'll be able to integrate it. And from that good advice, I stopped dreaming about making films. And then a week later, I met a woman named Glennis Redman, who's a marvelous poet and friend, and I decided to make a video about her life. And so I did, and I learned to make documentaries by making a documentary of hers. And on a side note, at the same time, I saw this movie called Starship Troopers, which was a blockbuster, horrible film, excuse me, but it was horrible. And it was the whole cast had perfect teeth and looked like they were from Malibu and well-fed, Americans, and went off to kill these poor spiders that I was so on the side of on this planet. And I called Sony, and I said, how much money I found a producer who was willing to talk to me. It was like, I can't remember what it was. It was like, felt like a bajillion dollars. And between the dreams and that movie, the dreams I was having about making films and that movie and then meeting Glennis, I felt like a gauntlet had been dropped in front of me. It's like, well, if someone can make something really horrible for millions of dollars, I could make better things for way, way less. So all of that conspired for me to make documentaries, and I had a wonderful, wonderful time of making a lot of children's environmental pieces, a lot of pieces for artists, all stuff I believed in that's mostly in service to different populations, which I've enjoyed. And in regards to elders, one of the things that Joe and I feel the privilege of is we've just sort of stumbled sideways into relationships with people from a lot of different traditions and who've become family, like Bob, like Uncle Bob Randall in Australia, and some people from Africa and people from Hindu religions and Native American elders, just as a kind of unfolding in our life that kind of got magnified when we got married. And so we feel the blessing of elders. We feel the profound responsibility that comes from really having lovely elder people to treasure in your life. And Kaylin, who I don't call an older person, who is not, who's older than me but not an old person, is definitely one of those people who I hope will be the subject of an awakened call as well. She's one of the astonishing people in my life, and her eloquent quote is, reminds me of a conversation she and I had about bees, where we were talking about the expression the canary in the coal mine, which, you know, comes from a tradition of bringing canaries into coal mines so that if the canary stopped singing or keeled over, you know, the miners knew to put their gear on or get out of the mine. And there's an expression that's come about since colony collapse disorder with bees, that bees are the canary in the coal mine, is an indicator species for, you know, how all of life is doing, which is like kind of challenged right now. But in my conversation with Kaylin, our perspective that we shared is that's a great expression to indicate something, but how about the canary? You know, it's how about we get past this looking at canary as an indicator rather than a canary as someone with its own right to well-being, as bees also have a right to well-being. long answer. I hope that kind of touches in some of what you wanted.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And I'm also curious, like, about your childhood. Like, were there any, and maybe the biggest influences in your life as you were growing up, and also maybe leading into what your first memorable experience with bees?
Well, let me answer the last part of that first. I never planned to be a beekeeper, but I've always loved animals and have felt like it took me till my 20s to kind of get a little bit of the hang of humans, probably till my 30s to feel the privilege of being a spirit in human form. Animals, insects, birds, the natural world was always easy for me and kind of my preference. And I remembered after I became a beekeeper, bee steward, bee minder, that I flashed on this time as a young girl. I mean, I was a little older than a toddler, but we had a very safe neighborhood where I grew up, and so my parents let me wander around. I remember picking up honeybees from our sidewalk. I lived in a suburb of Chicago, and we had a lot of DDT sprayed in our area. It's a wonderful, it's a kind of marvel that I don't have three arms and four legs. We had, you know, all kinds of chemicals sprayed in our street because of trying to keep the Dutch elms alive. So between that and probably bees just naturally being at the end of their lives, I would find honeybees sometimes, and I'd pick them up on my finger. I had no fear. I would go all the way back around the block to our garden and put them on a flower. So there was something to my relationship with bees that was just kind of instinctive. And in terms of formative relationships as a child, I'd say the two strongest ones were my grandparents, my maternal grandparents, who were Illinois farmers, who were kind and gentle and never had a cross word ever in my experience with them, always deeply appreciative, very respectful in their practices with chickens and cows and pigs and soybeans and corn. It was really, I'm glad that they passed before the genetic crops came in and things like that. It would have I think, broken their hearts for, you know, understandable reasons. And then my other big influence, my parents had a great acceptance, and I'd say especially my mother, but also my father, of kind of the way I was as a child, as a kind of sensitive. And my first playmate was a blue man. And I think I've said this to Kaylin and Joe, but maybe not a lot of other people. A tall blue man that was under our dining room table, who was invisible to everybody else. I remember him playing with him for hours and hours. My mother would just let me get on with playing with him as a toddler. And he was a wise, safe being that I feel like in a sea of taking a while to get used to humans and thinking and choices, there was a kind of grounding there and something very sweet and authentic. So there you are. There's an answer.
That's beautiful, beautiful that you had such nurturing from your parents and grandparents as well. And that's a phenomenal story about, you know, you carrying the honeybees back to your garden. Telling kind of so indicative of what was to come. We have a question that's come in from Mish Rosen, who says, Deborah, a truly wonderful and fascinating listen. She also has a little icon of a honeybee that she sent in.
Oh, I love those.
I am buzzing with curiosity. Two questions. Do you feel colony collapse is environmentally caused, or might it be possible that the turmoil in our world and the energies therefrom might be affecting the bees? And then two, I communicate with the feral cats I care for by sharing eye contact. They respond to my call and can be affectionate with me. Wondering how this is done with bees. Can they be affectionate, and if so, how? What are the ways you and the bees share yourselves with one another? Thank you, Mish from New York City.
Oh, beautiful questions. I'd like to spend time with everybody over tea. let me see. I've got the second question noted. Oh, yeah. In terms of colony collapse disorder, I think all of it's true. The obvious answers that people give that I also agree with are a very polluted environment, the use of Roundup, which is devastating for bees, but it's also devastating for humans and dogs and cats, et cetera, encroached habitat, current breeding practices with bees that are governed by commercial intent, killing queens every year or two, discouraging swarms, which is a very natural, life-giving, generative ways for bees to express themselves and reproduce. And I also feel definitely that the chaos of the world, bees are so, so sensitive. They're, you know, they're lovers of sunlight. I mean, they relate to sunlight amongst many invisible cues to go as far as 5 miles from their hive to get what they need and to come back exactly to the hive. So these finely tuned, sensitive beings, in my opinion, are definitely affected by the whole field of what's there, including what's unseen and less visible. And those are the things that aren't always given the research dollars, which, you know, which to me ultimately doesn't matter. I don't kind of negotiate or navigate my life through experts, quote unquote. But I think that definitely and so when I go to the bee yard, all those things that I mentioned, you know, the calmness and the loving presence, the being slow, the being respectful, the being humble. All of those things really are ultimately an energetic, are expressions of my heart and energy and intent. And those, in my experience, count more than anything. I mean, if I drop a frame or something like that, heaven forbid I should ever do that, but it's happened a few times. If, you know, if I do something where I move too quick, you know, those things can disturb bees. But if I bring, more than anything, if I bring a loving presence in all the adjectives that are sort of around that, all the practices that are around that, as a presence around the bees, I don't personally experience them as affectionate, like a puppy might be affectionate, but I feel their ease and a seamlessness between where I start and they begin, that the seeming, you know, edge between species disappears. And we co-create, we coexist in the same space, and the felt perception of that is unbelievably beautiful. And I think we all have a sense of that, whether it's with bees or some other life form that we love. And so I definitely experience those things. I might not call it affection, but, you know, on the other hand, if a bee lands in my hand because it's come back with a big load of pollen and my hand is near the hive and it's a resting place, I'm certainly feeling affection. It's certainly feeling safe and not threatened by my presence. And I'm that so gladdens my heart, I can't even tell you. Those are lovely questions.
And a beautiful answer. That description of, you know, feeling their ease where you end and they begin and the seamlessness of that, that's remarkable. And something that we can tap into in any relationship. And I guess that really is the practice.
I think that's the only thing going on, actually. It's just our perception of boundaries and human agendas, our fear, our distress, our chaos, our stress that's manifesting. All of these things promote a kind of edge thinking, a kind of territorial type thing, when in fact the natural world is just busy extending itself in all the ways that we do. And if we can cultivate some kind of quiet, whether it's a formal practice, you know, with meditation or just simply walking, time spent in nature, time spent in a park, time spent, whatever it is, everyone has an inclination in some form or fashion. If we can do that and get quiet enough, then we can become present enough to then come into relationship, which is always on tap and always available if we can show up for it.
That, you know, that is reminding me of something we do here and in several other parts of the world called Karma Kitchen, and it's a pay it forward restaurant where it's either once a week or once a month or at random we'll take over a restaurant, a regular restaurant, but we'll bring in volunteers, we take all the prices off the menu, and the idea is to, like, what happens when we take the transactional element out of eating together, you know, and does that drop us into a place where we're actually are able to see the ways we are connected, and does that change the conversation? Does that change our experience? And it does. You know, we're 10 years into it now, and it's been remarkable. And what I think is really intriguing about the work that you're doing is that you've chosen not to go the commercial route with it. And could you speak a little more about that?
Yes, it's been my natural inclination, and I feel like we fell out of relationship with bees and into business, you know, with this kind of bees as livestock thing, as many life forms are treated as livestock. It just never was in me. And when I started beekeeping, you know, which was 12 or 13 years ago, there weren't a lot of people out there that I was aware of who had the same inclination. But in fact, they were there, that we were all just kind of, I don't know, in the closet, we've emerged. So I have a list that, again, if there's some place I can post it or add it or share it, of my top, you know, bee peeps in the world, from the Netherlands to England to, you know, a lot of people around the U.S., who actually were quietly getting on with natural practices, compassionate practices, very much resonant with this conversation, but just kind of off the radar. And as I go around the world, I feel like, again, one of my jobs is just to people come to me all the time and say, well, I don't want to use chemicals. I don't want to feed my bees sugar water, you know, take their honey and feed them sugar water is a predominant thing. I don't want to kill the queens. And I'm able to reflect back their compassionate choices as a sane, not marginalized thing. So I'm a kind of a mother confessor for beautiful people who have beautiful inclinations who aren't able to find that in a lot of, not all, but not in some of the contemporary practices and mindsets. And there are more people out there like that. It's just that it's taking us a while to find each other. And with the strengthening of that, with the kind of just the blessing of knowing that, yes, a relationship with bees is the thing. The rest is what it is. That's growing and changing beekeeping into bee tending, bee stewarding, bee minding, bee caring, all that. There's an effort in language to reflect what it is that's true, most true about our relationship with bees, that's gaining ground these days.
And so your bees, like, you don't collect honey or use the wax or anything. You're holding space for them to just thrive.
Yes, I'm mostly doing that. I've only harvested twice in all my years, and that's when about 2 months ago was one of the times, because I just had an abundance of honey. But I let the honey accumulate for the bees. I have what I call a honey bank. I just have the frames available so that when a new colony comes into my life or catch a swarm or there's a low food season, I have frames of honey to give the bees. And then I had such an excess, I was able to harvest some as thank you presents for people. You do end up naturally with some excess wax just through life with the bees. Sometimes colonies die. There's things that happen. So I'm actually in this week going to explore how to make a solar wax melter and use it for some encaustic projects, and also to share with other artists who do that. But mostly I leave the things for, leave everything for the bees. And there's definitely mindful ways you can harvest honey if beekeepers can wait a year. And if they get bees in the spring, that's usually how people start. Wait until the next spring when the what's called the honey flow, the really intense nectar times begins. Then what you've got extra, you could take some of that for your family and then leave some for kind of insurance purposes for the bees. There's ways to be mindful about that, but in general, the mainstream practices could be more mindful than they are.
It's just, thank you so much for opening kind of all of these little windows, of wisdom for us. And I was thinking about how in our world we have such a human-centric view of existence, and such a, at least in the mainstream, a value that we place on human intelligence. and that blinds us in many ways, I think, to the many, many other forms, the myriad other forms of intelligence that exist in the world. And can you speak a little bit to us about what you've learned about bee intelligence?
Well, to me, there's nothing that's not intelligent about bees, and I feel like as I step into their, you know, the space of a colony, or if I tune in, I don't have to actually be with them. You know, I think if we're around bees, we don't have to literally be around them. I'm more finely calibrated if I'm really there again with all those qualities, you know, being calm and present and loving and respectful and humble. Then I have an opportunity to recalibrate as a spirit in a human form that's palpable. I feel more humming inside, if I could put it that way. I feel more balanced. I feel mind, body, and spirit more aligned. It's a way that, it's why my bee art is a sanctuary. It's why bees are very holy beings as far as I'm concerned. And I think that intelligence exists with every life form. So that's why when people say, how can I help the bees? I say, well, who do you love? And if it doesn't happen to be bees, you know, if somebody's thing is, you know, I have friends who love Pomeranian dogs, they love them. I think if we align with the intelligence of whoever it is that we love, that's part of the conspiracy of love and opportunity of love of being a spirit in any kind of form, and especially humans, I think have come to learn in this life on this planet, that all the wisdom in the world is around us all the time if we're quiet, respectful enough, and intentional enough, loving enough, present enough, especially present enough to receive what's there. It's a holy business, this living, if we pay attention.
are there any kind of like unique, I mean, I'm sure there are, but unique capacities or unique manifestations that the bees bring about? I think for many of us, we're this is a very, very new territory in terms of like even understanding the bee's life. And I was really moved when you were speaking earlier, and you know, we're tearing up when you were talking about we're asking the hardest working creatures on the planet to work harder. Could you, for those of us who may be bee novices, could you share a little bit about, you know, the just the beauty and the magnificence and the wonder of these creatures and what they do?
Ooh, some of the presentations I do are just about that. That's, you know, when I talk about the alchemy of, and the making of honey, which is a true miracle, when I talk about the evolution of bees and flowers, that they came into the life of the world, call it 50 million years ago, together, the wonders of a bee making a journey from a flower that can be 5 miles away, having the exquisite capacity to find a way all the way back to the hive with a heavy load of beautiful pollen. When I experience queen piping, when I am around, if I, you know, lift a frame of bees, if I do go into a hive for a particular reason, and just, you know, if I'm quiet enough, just being a holy witness to festooning, which is the young worker bees, you know, making chains, what I call lace, in a very Cirque du Soleil fashion, because they're making comb, is part of the process of making comb. When I smell the virgin wax, which is one of the most relaxing, most beautiful essences on earth, just really, if I could call myself anything more than an educator, it's a bee, sharing inspiration from bees as to how they've changed my life and just the marvelous things they naturally do. And that is what, if I can do that well, then it doesn't matter if anybody has bees, which I don't think is important that everybody has bees. It's more that we need bee appreciators more than bee keepers or bee minders. And if we can just hold an appreciation for the magic and the utter mystery and holiness and sacredness of what these beings get on with doing despite our trash in the environment, you know, to their last breath, even when they're not well, it's so inspiring that we come away as better people. And I feel like I'm a better person because of these six-legged rinpoches, these bearers of them.
I love that. Six-legged Rinpoche's. I'm going to go to our next caller here. Thank you, Deborah.
Okay. Hi, Deborah. This is Wendy from Half Moon Bay, and always such a pleasure to listen to you. So I'm
Thank you, and hi, Wendy.
Hi. So I am also, I guess I'd consider it a bee appreciator, and I'm just looking at my backyard. And I'm wondering, how do bees relate to other beings in the yards? How do they relate? Or maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the relationship with flowers, or how are they relating to, you know, butterflies or hummingbirds, or I'm just kind of thinking them as part of the whole of the backyard and of our world, and how do they have relationships with other beings? We've talked about with humans, but how about other creatures?
Well, it's a great question. I think the wholeness you refer to is just, that's just who they are, except for the situation of if I have a hive, and like I did last year, that got robbed out by another colony of bees. That happens in the times when there's less food, and sometimes there's just a freak event of it. It hasn't happened much in my life. It does happen sometimes, but that's just a very particular thing that can happen. But bees out in your garden, out in the fields, out in the world, out in the bushes, and every other pollinator under the sun, moon, and stars generally are very simpatico with each other. You know, I might have the occasional bald-faced hornet that comes and is a predator of an occasional honeybee. It's not a situation in my part of the world. But that's like a very one-off minor thing. Generally, bees, wasps, yellow jackets, beetles, ants. If you see a field of something like buckwheat or clover, which some people plant as cover crops, which is great for pollinators, and somebody just emailed, oh God, was this Luann was talking about, I can't remember, it was Luann or someone else who talked about this with me the other day. I set a chair next to our buckwheat field when it comes, because you can attract hundreds of pollinators. We have about 4,500 in our region, and I swear almost all of them turn up. And you see how they're all working the nectar. It's not generally a competitive situation in a natural, healthy world. And it's actually very inspiring if you can be around a garden like you are and just put yourself in the way of all these beings just interacting in a way that's just, they're getting on with their intent. They're all seeking some kind of nectar and pollen if they're pollinators, and that includes ants and beetles and moths and butterflies and every kind of stinging and non-stinging creature. It's a real great example of what could be possible of humans if we could, you know, remember ourselves a little more. And if people were listening to the Owl Network and the Awaken Calls more, you know, things like that, we have this opportunity to remember more who we more truly are.
Well, thank you so much, Deborah.
You're welcome, Wendy.
Thank you, Deborah. This call has just flown by, and we do have, before we close at the end, we have one last question that we do ask all of our guests, and that is, what can we, as the extended service space Awaken Calls community, what can we do to support and further your work in the world?
Golly, you know what's been so interesting is the things that have gotten posted, because I've been traveling and I haven't done Facebook for a month and I just dipped in. I had so many people sending me the link to this that I have to say already, and I heard from old friends I haven't heard from in a long time. I just thank you for already what you're doing and the way you're doing it. Focusing on, you know, great subjects and doing the work. The logistics on how this kind of thing actually works, how you can call and talk with the world, is totally beyond me and not my forte. So the balance of right brain, left brain, good-hearted people involved in all of this, I just say continue to do what you're doing. I'm so deeply grateful to you.
Well, we will definitely continue to do that. It's a joy to come across people like you who are truly following what they love, and it brightens our world in just immeasurable ways. You've shared such richness on this call, and we will definitely send out links to your work as well as any the recording that you would like to send or any other resources that you'd like us to point callers to. We can definitely send that out. We will I feel like we could continue this call. There's so many.
Yeah,
we still
too.
Need to find out like why we shouldn't be buying almonds, but we'll maybe stick that in an email. Or is there a quick answer to that?
Quick answer to that is on my website, which is available to everybody on Holy Bee Press. There's an articles page, and there's an article I wrote called The High Cost of Almonds for Bees, and that explains that in full. And I appreciate that that was raised earlier, I think, by Luann. There's a difference between almonds produced in the U.S. and what I would call Ahimsa almonds, which are less available here, but there's a few. But there's it talks about the almond production is at the heart of a huge pollination event annually that's unique to America and the stress it puts on bees. And so that you can find that there.
Wonderful. Thank you. I will definitely make sure we send that out as well so those interested can follow up. And now we will close out the call with a lot of gratitude with the same moment of silence that we began with, just to sort of, you know, marinate in all the goodness and to beam that out in the ways that we can to wherever it's needed in the world. So a moment of silent gratitude, and then I will unmute our callers so they can say thank you in with their voices. So a moment of silence. Thank you.
Right.
Thank you all. And I'm unmuting, and on the count of three, we will say thank you, Deborah. One, two, three.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.